Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Zora O'Neill, author of the new book, All Strangers Are Kin, Adventures in Arabic and the Arab World. In the book, Zora visits four Middle Eastern countries over the course of a year. She spends several weeks in each place studying the Arabic language and its local dialects. In addition to sharing her lessons learned, she guides us through the people, history, culture, and food of these regions. Zora proves to be an excellent guide, which is no surprise, given her background as a freelance travel and food writer who's authored or co-authored more than a dozen guidebooks for Lonely Planet, Rough Guides, and Moon. Her work has also appeared in the New York Times and Condé Nast Traveler. Zora O'Neill, thanks for being here on KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, we'll start from the beginning here. You grew up in New Mexico in a somewhat non-traditional household. Your parents were, in the words of Pete Townsend, hippie gypsies at one time, who had knocked about Germany, Bulgaria, Turkey, and Tangier. Did you get your love of travel from them?
Yeah, definitely. Even though we didn't travel at all when I was a kid, you know, we were sort of in the back of beyond of New Mexico, and it was just hard to get out. The only places we went were car trips to L.A. and to New Jersey to visit family, but we didn't travel internationally, but they had brought so much of their travels with them to our house, and we had souvenirs and recipes and stories of all their adventures. And I think that definitely put me on the path to thinking the normal thing is to go out and explore the world as soon as you have a chance.
Did you have any bucket lists as a kid of places you really wanted to see?
When I was studying French in high school, because I was so contrary that I studied French in high school in New Mexico instead of Spanish, which I still regret. But when I was studying French, I didn't want to go to France. That would be too easy. I wanted to go to Senegal and Vietnam, to use my French. And I still have never been to either of those places. One day, though.
They're still on your list, though.
They are.
Now, you've written and contributed to many travel guidebooks before this book, Lonely Planet, Rough Guides, Moon, all the big names, really. How'd you get your start doing that?
I answered an ad. It was very straightforward. I was freelancing. I started freelancing in 2000 and sort of casting about trying to be a travel writer and not really knowing how to go about it. And I look back at some of those pitches I sent to editors then, and no wonder it wasn't working. Anyway.
how not to write a pitch.
I know. I was like, this place looks cool. Why didn't you send me there? And, you know, I was right. It was an up-and-coming destination, but I had no qualifications to write about it. Anyway, so I was casting about, and a friend of mine sent me an ad for Moon Guidebooks, and they were recruiting people to write their city guides, a new series they were starting. And, you know, it was a simple, like, write a sample restaurant review and tell us why you want to write this guide. And I ended up being able to work on the New York City guide. And that was where I was working. And it just sort of snowballed from there.
Oh, New York City was the first one. I would have thought your New Mexico books.
No, those came later, actually. Yeah, I did a little chunk of the New York City guide, and which was really fun. I did the whole hotels section, and I'd never actually been in any hotels in New York because I lived there. So I got to, like, snoop around and, you know, pretend to be a tourist in all these neighborhoods I never would have ordinarily gone to. So
a little
it was great.
Kind of upper crust neighborhoods.
Very and, much. I know I'd come in and be like, my sister-in-law is coming into town. We might need, you know, she's going to need a hotel. They're very particular. They can't stay with me. Anyway, I had all these cover stories.
Now, with all your travel experiences and interests over that time, why'd you choose learning Arabic in the Arab world as the subject for this book?
Well, I had given up on Arabic, to be honest. In 1998, after I got my master's degree and I left grad school, I was really frustrated with grad school. I was really frustrated with Arabic, and because I'd sort of gone down this super obscure path with it, and there was nothing to be done. And then, you know, over the years, I've really found I missed it. I finally got a guidebook job updating the Lonely Planet Guide to Egypt in 2007, And that was, I like to point out, that was the first time I got paid for knowing Arabic and for my master's degree. But so in 2007, I went back to Egypt, and that was when I was like, oh, I remember this language. It's still in my head. I can't believe it. And that kind of got me on this path. I mean, I'd been thinking in the back of my head, there's a big lack in what people in America know about the Middle East. And all the news that was coming through was so different from what I had experienced living there.
We just hear about revolutions and terrorism.
Exactly. All the bad stuff. And you don't know, you don't have any of the normal stuff to set it against, any of the kind of typical daily life stuff. So it kind of all clicked together in the few years after that Lonely Planet job, where I was like, oh, the best way of talking about normal life in the Arab world is through language, because it sort of doesn't necessarily have any political ramifications. You don't have to get into all this, all the stuff that pundits always talk about. You can talk about language, and it varies across the Arab world, and it's just a really rich subject, and I could be a total language nerd and get back into talking about the weird things that I like about Arabic. So,
and I've read that you said that you were lucky in that you pitched the book at just the best time. What made this time so fortuitous for you?
Oh, well, I have a little pang, like, even thinking back to that year, 2011. So, you know, the Arab Spring, all the popular uprisings started in late 2010, continued into 2011, and the optimism in the beginning of 2011 was so high. And for once, I was looking at the news, and I was seeing the news, the coverage of the Egyptian revolution. And I was like, for once, the world is getting to see how fantastic Egyptians are. Like, this is what I remember of Egypt, and people with all their funny signs and their super clever songs and sort of the whole culture that developed around the revolution. So that was very, you know, out there in the news, and just the general attitude toward the Arab world in America was so optimistic. And it was during that summer that I finally wrapped up my book proposal and was able to shop it around. And I think I really benefited from this window of like, oh, an interesting, optimistic, funny book about Arabs. Yes, we can publish that.
So during the peak of optimism with the Arab Spring and all that.
Yeah.
For the Middle East.
Yeah. And then, of course, while I was writing it, everything sort of took a turn for the much, much worse. But, you know, here we are, and I think it's more useful than ever, honestly.
Let's get to the book itself. It's divided into four parts, and this is based on the countries where you study Arabic. Egypt, the Gulf, specifically United Arab Emirates and Qatar, then Lebanon and Morocco. Why'd you choose these four regions?
Well, they're very, so one of the things I wanted to talk about in the book is how we in America think of the Arab world as all one thing. And in fact, it's a huge range of cultures. And each country not only has a very different culture, but also has very different dialect. Arabic is also not all one language. There's a written language and there are spoken languages that depend on the country. And those countries that I picked, the four countries, really represent broadly, like, each of the major dialects. Egyptian dialect is very much its own thing that people across the Arab world know from TV and movies, and it was a place I knew best. And then the Gulf dialect is very strong. In Lebanon, that's a dialect there is sort of a part of a greater, like, Levantine dialect. And then Morocco represents a sort of outlying North African dialect.
We tend, like you said, we tend to think of the Arab world as homogeneous. They're all Arabs and they're all pretty much the same and they all think alike and eat the same food, which is definitely not true, as you mentioned. You used a very nice metaphor of the Arab world as a quilt made up of all these, this patchwork from all these different regions in the Middle East.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really, Arabic language is the thread that sort of ties it all together. Even though the language varies from country to country, there's still the heritage of the Arabic language. And there was actually a big movement in the 1950s and 60s of Arab nationalism that basically said, no matter what your background, if you speak Arabic, you are an Arab. And it had it resonated really powerfully across that area to this idea that you could all be united under no matter how different the cultures and the foods and your local political whatever, you could be part of this greater culture just by speaking this language.
Now, you were traveling pretty much by yourself in these countries. Your husband had come over for just it seemed like a few days to a week.
In
a few places.
He makes a few cameo appearances.
Cameo appearances, yes. And actually, I think he's the star of the book. No, just kidding.
But, I'll tell him he said that. He'd be very flattered.
But you were asked in an interview how safe it is to travel in the Arab world, certainly as a solo woman. It's something most of us wonder about, if we have that on our bucket list to travel there. You had such a great answer. You said, remember that the human ability to maintain normalcy is very strong. Can you give us an example or two of that from your travels?
Wow. Well, without, it's kind of inspiring. I mean, yeah, people were like, oh, isn't it dangerous? I'm seeing all these bad things in the news as usual. And I'm like, it's amazing how close you can be to trouble. And yet there is still someone there to sell you tea. I was in Egypt in the fall of 2011, just as the whole revolution sort of project was becoming much more complicated. And there were more and more violent demonstrations that the military council was putting down violently. And I happened to be right next to one, like within a few blocks. And I could see there was upset and it was disturbing. I mean, fortunately, I didn't see any direct violence myself, but I knew something was terrible was going on. And I just got in the metro and I went home to the other side of Cairo. And it was like nothing had happened. I kind of expected the whole city to be in an uproar. But people are, business has to go on. People have to go to work. It's kind of encouraging to see. And there was also some strange stuff that happened in Lebanon while I was there. And, Lebanon sort of lives in this constant state of, are things going to go back to total chaos? We just don't know. And yet, Beirut is an incredibly dynamic city. Cairo is an incredibly dynamic city. And people want normalcy and crave normalcy and sort of maintain that at all costs. Well, not at all costs, I shouldn't say. That's a little bit glib. But that the fact that everyone has that goal in mind, if you happen to wander into or up next to something strange going on, you'll always have allies in sort of like, let's protect ourselves and keep things going as best we can.
Now, along those same lines, in the book's first section, you mentioned one of your major reasons for studying Arabic was to use the language as, I quote from the book, a social connector. What do you mean by a social connector in terms of the book and your goals here?
Well, so that really stands in opposition to how I had been using Arabic, which was really just to read really old poems. And I love old poems, and I do feel, a certain connection with 6th century Arabic poets. But it is not the same as being able to crack a joke with somebody or sort of discuss the topics of the day with, the guy who's sitting next to you in the cafe. And I really never, because I got so embroiled in this 6th century poetry, I really lost any skills I might have developed early on in speaking to people. I loved being in the Arab world, but I wasn't always using the language as well as I could. So I really wanted to go back and just focus on talking and make friends.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Zora O'Neill, author of the new book, All Strangers Are Kin, Adventures in Arabic and the Arab World. In the book, you're talking about you're reading the older texts, poetry from the 6th century. You mentioned that there's these two main branches of Arabic, which I think you've alluded to already. The traditional formal language, which you call modern standard Arabic or Fusha.
Exactly.
And the colloquial or vernacular versions. What are the differences? Is Fusha generally used for literary purposes and then the vernacular is used for conversations?
Yeah, that's basically the distinction. And the Fusha, the modern standard Arabic, is very consistent, relatively consistent across the Arab world. And it's basically all written material is in modern standard Arabic. That is changing that's changing a lot now with sort of younger generations. And for all kinds of reasons, you see a lot more written dialect. But predominantly Fosha is written. Spoken language, you know, people will write it like in text messages and things like that, but it's not standardized. There are very few dictionaries and certainly nothing that Arabs consult. It's really just nerdy language learners who
need
these things.
What about like a television news report? Is that colloquial
or
would that be?
Good point. That's the one, pretty much the only case where the Fusha, the modern standard Arabic, is spoken aloud. And it's basically, so if you're listening to an Al Jazeera newscast, they're speaking this modern standard Arabic, and they're basically reading it off a teleprompter. But if you listen to an Al Jazeera chat show where they're discussing issues, then most people are speaking dialect. And they're probably, because it's a more abstract conversation, often then they're using a little bit more modern standard Arabic vocabulary and making a little more effort to speak neutrally in a way. So people sort of modulate their use of Arabic over the course of a day and, you know, their context and things.
Oh, you did mention in the book one funny instance of it where you said some kids' television shows like SpongeBob SquarePants, you had seen dubbed into Fusha.
Yes, yeah.
Which kind of was fairly jarring.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. That's really funny. Yeah, the modern standard Arabic is still used for dubbing for a lot of kids' stuff because the idea is that it's supposed to be educational, but it's the most jarring because most parents feel really awkward about speaking to their kids in that language or even reading to their kids in that language because it is not naturally how you talk to kids. I mean, usually you use this cute colloquial, you have all kinds of cute colloquial words for talking to kids.
Right, not honorable son.
Exactly, exactly. Wilt thou go to bed, my dearest one?
That's pretty much how it would sound if it was translated.
Kind of, yeah. And then you see like, you know, all the Disney movies are dubbed into modern standard Arabic. And then there's actually a bit of a campaign to Disney to dub the movies in different Arabic dialects to make them more sort of more enjoyable and not sounding like this incredible chore of an old language when you listen to them.
Now, in the Cairo section, you had already talked about you were there during some upheaval. You mentioned in the book it was 8 months after that revolution, so January 25th, 2011. Was the revolution in Cairo. I think the Arab Spring began a few months before in Tunisia. I was wondering, it must have been an exhilarating time to be in Egypt, but also probably a dangerous time. Not that they're mutually exclusive.
Right. I was there in, I guess, September, October of 2011, and it was very noticeable the change in tone from when I first arrived to when I left. And when I got there, people were still incredibly giddy. I talk about this in the book. People would just come up to me and see that I was a foreigner, assume I was American, and be like, did you see what we did? Some guy, you know, was see what we did, American? Like, you know, giving me thumbs up and like, we're with you now. We're on the side of democracy. Things are going to work out. And people were just out in the street in a really optimistic way. And while I was there, as I said, there were some demonstrations that were put down very violently, and it was the first indicator that things were not going to work out very well. And
the government was only going to allow it up to a point.
Right. Things now are arguably much worse than they were before Mubarak was kicked out. And I did make a little pact to my husband before I left. He was like, if there's any demonstrations, you have to promise to walk away from them, not toward them.
Would you be tempted usually?
And I was kind of tempted. I was like, well, that's really obvious advice. And yes, I will take it. And then I was there at that time, there were sort of routinely demonstrations on Fridays. And I happened to be near the center of Cairo on a Friday with someone who was like, oh, let's go down and see what's happening. And I was like, oh, I will. Okay, I'll go this time. I don't think anything's, and nothing was happening. It was very,
fortunately,
it was kind of depressing, actually, how dispirited the whole thing had been. And speaking of people being there to sell you tea, there was, you know, street vendors and like people standing around being like, oh, what do we do now?
Oh,
anyway,
no.
Yeah.
Now, in the next section on the Gulf, we get actually the title of the book. You mentioned it's a line from the poet Imrul Al-Qais.
Yes.
Did I pronounce that close?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's pretty good.
And the line is, all strangers are kin to one another. Why'd you choose this line for the title of the book?
Well, in the context of the poem, he's talking about the solidarity you feel with other outsiders when you're traveling, how, you know, you can suddenly see somebody who's not your ethnicity, your country, or whatever, and you kind of have this nodding familiarity with them just because you're both foreigners in this other land. But taken out of that context and put into the context of all my travels, I really, what ended up coming out of all my travel experiences was just this incredible sense of sort of, we have everything in common. All the people I met, we have all the same concerns about, you know, love lives and work and do I stay in this country? Do I go? You know, what else should I study? What else should I do with my life? And these very common things.
Much more in common than we have differences between us.
Definitely, definitely. And I also, you know, I was sort of the outsider everywhere I went. And I think people confided in me a bit just because I was this stranger passing through and they could tell me all their stories.
Confessions
exactly,
and things like that.
Exactly.
There's actually a few really good ones in the book. Mm. I won't spoil it for people. After the Gulf section, you traveled to Lebanon and studied at school in Beirut. We already talked about that a little and mentioned that here, you know, in the U.S. and maybe most of the West, Beirut is often synonymous with a city in turmoil and under siege. And here in Portland, George Bush Sr. used to refer to Portland as Little Beirut because it was always big trouble for him when he came here. We weren't fond of him.
Oh, my God. That's a little glib.
Was that the Beirut you experienced? Or was it a little more enlightening and more cultural? And
Beirut is fantastic. Many people adore it. I am very sensitive to conflict, which what might make you wonder why I am
Go off to the Middle East.
All the time. But let that be a lesson to you. Like, I get very nervous around people arguing and things like that.
Of course, you live in New York, so there's a little bit of that there.
That's right. Maybe I have a certain level. But overall, I did find Beirut kind of stressful because I was hyper aware of kind of the sectarian politics there. And well, there were not any, well, there were things happened that I talk about in the book, but Beirut is very popular sort of among Western travelers. It's sort of the place where even if you don't want to travel around the Middle East, you feel like you can go to Beirut. There's so much dynamic culture there, and, you know, people wear skimpy tank tops and mini skirts, and, you know, it's relatable in a way that some other parts of the Middle East aren't necessarily.
What I hear from people I know, I meet in the U.S. or Portland who are from Lebanon, they describe it as one of the most beautiful places on earth.
It's really, it's you know, it's a city on the Mediterranean, and it just, and sort of the mountains come down to the sea and the whole city is sort of, you know, staggered down toward the sea and it's gorgeous. And there are beaches up north and south of the city and everyone is fabulously glamorous and, you know, goes to the beach clubs and wears their bikinis and flirts. And I mean, it's
still that, oh, yeah. In your experience, that's not something I would ever think of.
Oh, no, it is super glamorous. And that's kind of why I went there, because I was like, I missed the whole, like, you know, revival of Beirut, and I want to get in on the glamour and the cool. It didn't really rub off on me.
I'm about to buy a ticket, I think. It sounds great.
It's pretty.
But,
and the food.
But there are some negatives there, too. Right?
There are some negatives. I mean, you can go and you can ignore the whole political situation and have a fabulous time. I just felt hyper aware of it because studying Arabic, I became very aware that there were subtle differences in the dialects between depending on what religious sect you were. And I got very self-conscious about that. And there are lots of things people won't talk about. You can't discuss. It's not polite to ask people what the village they're from, because that would indicate their background. So there's a very conscious, in Beirut, there's a very conscious effort to kind of be non-sectarian and kind of fence off that part of living in Lebanon and just say, like, this is a neutral zone. We live here and we're not going to discuss all these topics. And that I found very wearing, because I don't know.
There were topics you wanted to discuss.
Well, and it's like Arabic 101. Oh, where are you from? Kind of questions.
Right.
Or, you're not even supposed to ask people what sports teams they like, because that would indicate certain allegiances. Not that I know what to ask or anything, but it's some of the basic small talk is totally off limits. And I didn't even realize that going in. And
you just had to be a little bit more careful there.
Right.
Because of that sectarian differences.
Yeah.
Now, in the final section of the four, you're in Morocco and you're studying the Arabic language in the city of Fez. Your parents fly in from the U.S., from New Mexico, to join you in Tangier for the first time since they were there in 1967. Was that a goal of yours to have your parents share their memories there with you?
Well, I was sort of secretly working toward that.
They're divorced, I should mention, too.
Oh, yeah.
Long divorced.
Long divorced. They got divorced when I was, four or something. They get along fine. They live in different cities. The three of us had traveled together very briefly in New Mexico before that, but this was the longest we'd all traveled together. And to go back to this place where they have this whole history, and I was just sort of piggybacking. I mean, they were such good sports to come, and it was a treat to be able to tag along with them and sort of see, have them reminisce in the very place, like I'd heard their stories before, and then suddenly we could go to the cafe and where they told me, all these things had happened.
And you stayed at the hotel where they had stayed originally? That's amazing.
Oh, yeah, we didn't actually get to stay at that hotel because it had been turned into a cafe.
Oh, okay.
But we got to visit that hotel and got a top-to-bottom tour from the guy working there who was so excited. He's like, wow, that's, he was like, wow, more than 40 years you haven't been here, let me show you around, so...
It's also at Tangier, I should mention, when your parents were there, it's also where they got your name, Azura. Mm. Who was your namesake there? And you do search for her in the book. I won't give anything away beyond that.
My namesake, it doesn't sound glamorous, but it's a good story. She was my parents' laundry lady in Tangier, and she did the laundry for the hotel. And my mother really admired her because she was one of the only independent women she met in Morocco, which was rare in Morocco at that time and also quite rare in the United States. And so my mother wanted to confer that independence to me. Zora was a single mother. She owned her own business, whether by choice or because she had to. She was very much in charge of her own life. And my mother wanted to give me that. And I feel really honored.
Zora, it was a pleasure talking with you about the book. And again, thanks for coming to Cable. You'll be reading at Powell's on Hawthorne tonight. But by the time this airs, that'd be a little too late.
Yeah, sorry. You'll miss me.
But I wonder, could you leave our Cable listeners with a few parting words in Arabic?
Oh, good question. Well, I think the simplest thing to say is just Barakallahu fikum, which one of my teachers in Morocco explained, sort of the more standard way of saying thank you in Arabic is to say shukran or shukran jazilan or alf shukr, thank you very much, 1,000 thanks, you can sort of pile it on. But as he said, saying shukran is like saying thank you from the head, but if you say Barakallahu fikum, that's like saying thank you from the heart. So thank you from the heart for listening, Portland.
And we thank you from the heart. Thanks, Zora. We've been talking with Zora O'Neill, author of the new book, All Strangers Are Kin, Adventures in Arabic and the Arab World. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Zora for visiting us at KABU and to all of you for listening.
Walk like an Egyptian. Walk like an Egyptian.